I know some of you are taking a course from Simo and Alois on Wittgenstein. So if you've taken that course, I hope you've learned by now, at least this much. Namely that the tendency in the commentary, in the secondary literature on Wittgenstein, is to distinguish between two Wittgensteins. We tend to get called the early and the later Wittgenstein. And the tendency is to see the early Wittgenstein as starting to study with Russell, keep notebooks, letters. He's born around 1913. Some people might not think he's born until 1914, but that's roughly when the early Wittgenstein is born. And then he writes the Tractatus, finishes around 1918, keeps something like the same views. And then somewhere around 1929, when he comes back to Cambridge, or maybe a year later, he becomes the later Wittgenstein. Exactly which year, 1913, 1929, there's some disagreement about. But the disagreement is sort of tends to be a squabble over about a 12-month period on each end. So there's someone named the early Wittgenstein. These are roughly his dates. Roughly is good enough for my purposes. And then he becomes the later Wittgenstein. And then the later Wittgenstein is born. Often it seems sort of like on a dime, suddenly. He turns and attacks his earlier self. And we get the later Wittgenstein, and he just keeps writing things, keeps doing drafts of the same book, often, which is published as Philosophical Investigations, along with some other things. And he has his views. And so if people are writing about early Wittgenstein, they'll take things from the letters, the notebooks, the Tractatus, anything from this period, and they'll tend to treat it all as expressions of the views of a single philosopher, the later Wittgenstein, the early Wittgenstein. And anything from those texts equally bears on the same views of this one monolithic. There's very little search for substantive development in this period. Similarly, though it's not quite as extreme here, and there's disputes about this, the tendency for a very long time was to treat all of the writings published in this period as views of the later Wittgenstein. This is very pronounced, for instance, in the writings of Gordon Baker and Peter Hacker, when they want to show you what later Wittgenstein thinks philosophy is. Many of the quotations will come from the early 30s, but this will be in a commentary on the Investigations. So these are all views that tell you what later Wittgenstein thinks of philosophy. So these two philosophers, this is what he published. I do think that there's something to this. Certain things, certain substantive changes definitely happen here in Wittgenstein's thinking. And he starts to become concerned to criticize things he thought earlier in this period. And those criticisms don't go away. So it's not that there's no truth in this story. I think there is some truth in this story. But I also think that this story has blinded people to all kinds of other changes in Wittgenstein's thought. The tendency of thinking there is a person, the early Wittgenstein, and a person, the later Wittgenstein, has led to people missing, I think, forms of development in his philosophy, or changes of mind that I think are just as deep and interesting as the one that happens here, even if this one is interesting, too. So, there are many of these, but in this talk, I will briefly be concerned with one, and mostly concerned with the other. I'll be concerned with one change of mind that takes place within the period of the early Wittgenstein. Fundamental change in his thinking that takes place between the notebooks and the Tractatus. And another very fundamental change of mind that takes place within the period that's usually treated as all belonging to the lifespan of the later Wittgenstein. And that will be my main topic, but it will be helpful to have both. So that's just an overview of what I'll be doing today. The change that takes place in this period has to do with how, in many ways, the Tractatus is criticizing the views of Russell and some of the views of Frege that early Wittgenstein was originally attracted to. It's the ways in which that book is a self-critique. And that topic is something that's been written about a lot under the heading of what's sometimes called a resolute reading of the Tractatus. So part of what, there's many things that stands for, but one thing it stands for is the way in which certain views about the nature of logic, language, nonsense, philosophical clarification, and so forth, are views that Wittgenstein is now criticizing in that book that earlier he held. And so if one just takes everything out of that book as a quotation, one can attribute to Wittgenstein. And one doesn't worry about the dialectic of the book. Where does this figure and what happens to those remarks? What it means to say they are rungs on a ladder when it's supposed to climb up and throw away, one misses some of the action in the book. This talk, so that has to do with this break, which I'll come back to. The other break comes here, and I thought this was a good talk to give in Bergen for reasons that will become clear. I'm going to mark this break at 1937. Sorry, this magic marker is dying fast. That may be the last thing you get out of it. Any date for a change in Wittgenstein's view is a little bit arbitrary, because these things are things that happen incrementally. He gets clearer and clearer about things. You can see each change of his thought prefigured. An earlier point, you can see him much clearer about it. A later point, to pick a moment in time for a fundamental change in a philosopher's view, it's always going to be a little arbitrary, I think. But if I had to pick a time, it would be this. Yes?
You have some magic markers here.
Oh, you do? That's
Ellen,
lovely.
Ellen.
I hope they're more alive.
They can't help it be more alive. So,
thank you.
Look at that. 1937. Wittgenstein spent the 22 years between 29 and 51, this period that's usually thought of as the lifespan of the later Wittgenstein, what's true, and one reason why there's something non-arbitrary about that description, is that he spent that time, among other things, working on material that you can think of as drafts for a single book, in the sense that some of the earliest material over that period still survives all the way into the philosophical definitions. To say it still survives does not mean always that the sentences that are in the last book are just doing what they would have been doing if they were in the early book, but they still are all drafts of a single book. That's the sense in which there's something non-arbitrary about this. That's not to say that's all he wrote in this period by any means, but just the fact that there's nothing that was, if you will, drafts for the Tractatus that he's still working on here. So that's one sense in which this is a non-arbitrary classification. But about one third of the way through this period, starting the fall of 1936, August of 36 actually, he withdraws to Scholten, to this little house he had built for himself many years earlier in Sognefjord, and he spends most of the year there with a little break in December to visit his family in Vienna and to get away from the winter, I think. after this abortive start, he turns his attention in November of 1936, shortly before he goes to Vienna, to starting to rewrite what are now known to you as sections 1 to 189. Of the investigations. And roughly the first half of that material is reworked in the remaining 2 months of 1936, before and after this break during Christmas. And the second half of it, including most of the sections about philosophy, between 89 and 133, between February and May of 1937. So that happens, if you will, just up the order from here. And I'm partly going to be interested today in what was happening during that period when he's in Norway. And especially concerned with the question, what happens to sections 89 to 133? How are they rewritten so that they assume the form that they did? And one thing I'll be making is a kind of claim, systematic claim about a kind of change you can find in how those sections are rewritten. I can't completely prove that here. It would be a lot of work to do that. That's not a task for a lecture. But I thought it was an excellent claim to make in front of people who work in the Wittgenstein archive. Bergen, because they have the resources to go out and check and test what I say, and I'm inviting some people here to do that. I suppose especially Alois. I want you to get to work, Alois, after you hear this. So I'm interested in trying to bring to the surface a change, and it's a change not just about this issue or about that issue, but a change in Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy. What he thinks he's doing in philosophy, how he needs to do it, and therefore, in a sense, a change in his attitude towards a great many things he's written previously that takes place in this period. But before I go any further, let me be clear about something in case what I said already is not clear. This division of the early and the later Wittgenstein that has sedimented itself in the secondary literature presents itself as an answer to the question, when did the break come in Wittgenstein's philosophy? And when people have read some things I've written, especially about early Wittgenstein, they say some things about a break that comes here that makes the Tractatus look in some ways like the later philosophy, then I get the question, okay, well, so according to you, when did the break come? I don't think that's a good question. And then when I refuse to answer that question, I'm told that, well, then I hold a one Wittgenstein view. There isn't such a thing as the break, then I must hold the view that there's no break. And if there's no break, then he's always the same philosopher. And that's taken to be something like reductio, I guess, of one thing. What's true is, I guess, in some sense, I hold the one Wittgenstein view. I mean, I think this person who wrote here and here and here and here all had the same mother and father and the same brothers and so forth. But the only sense in which I hold the one Wittgenstein view is a fairly banal sense in which I hope everyone does. So my point is something more like, if one wants to individuate Wittgenstein's, then I don't think the magic number is two. The point is not to reduce that number to a smaller number, but to see that there are very fundamental changes in his thinking that happen at various points, and that one obscures a great deal that's very important in his development by trying to rotate everything around the single axis of this one moment, his development. And I think the tendency to do that has both caused this break and that break, among others, to become invisible, or very hard to really give their proper due. So, I don't think the question, where and when did the break come, admits of a single answer. So it's not my purpose today to advocate that we substitute one simple answer, 1937, for a different answer, 1929-30. That would be a complete misunderstanding of my talk. That would leave in place the idea that everything Wittgenstein wrote is to be assigned to either one of two non-overlapping developmental periods or phases. And it's precisely that way of approaching Wittgenstein's work, which is what I most want to do away with. So this talk is, if you will, an antidote. By trying to bring out an important change that happened here, I'm trying to offer a corrective, not to give a new answer to what I think is a bad question. My hope is that if we come to see what can be said on behalf of this answer, then we come to see better the actual, or some of the actual complexity of Wittgenstein's development, and therefore some of what we're blinded to on this more standard account of his development, some of what tends to go missing on the currently received tellings of the story of his development. Now, I'm going to introduce a device to do this, which is to distinguish two senses of what we might mean when we use this word in saying that Wittgenstein's conception, in order to bring out something about Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy. There's a tendency to say, now I think I'm one of the people that started this, so I'm guilty too, to say it's important to see that there's something piecemeal about Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy, that his method of clarification or philosophical interrogation or elucidation proceeds in a piecemeal manner, or as it now put in the German secondary literature, that it proceeds stückweise, bit by bit. What does that mean? And what I actually think is there's different things that could be at issue if you say this. So now in some of the recent secondary literature, there's this debate between the people who say, Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy is piecemeal. The ones that say, no, it isn't. And I'm actually supposed to be one of the people who say, yes, it is. But what I actually find when I read the debate is that I agree with both sides or neither side. Because I think different things get confused here. So what I want to do next is to distinguish two senses in which we can say of Wittgenstein that he went from having an anti-piecemeal conception of philosophy to a piecemeal conception. And the first of those changes is the one that took place here. And the second one is the one that took place here, 21 years later. So it's important to distinguish these. It's not the same issue at all. Also, some of the people who like what I've written, some of the more, shall we call them, zealous defenders of the resolute reading, say, well, Conant and Diamond have showed that Wittgenstein's view on the Tractatus is piecemeal. But then they seem to want to criticize. See, later Wittgenstein is criticizing his earlier self for holding an anti-piecemeal. So they contradict themselves. If he's piecemeal, he's piecemeal. And they're not, as it said, resolute enough. It's the criticism I get a lot from certain people. And I think this comes from being confused about what we're holding when we hold that. In the Tractatus, Wittgenstein had a piecemeal conception. So, what we're going to do next now is to distinguish two senses of piecemeal. Two different things that could be meant by saying somebody has a piecemeal or an anti-piecemeal conception of how to proceed in philosophy. I will call the first, for reasons that will become clear in a moment, the Goldfarb sense of piecemeal, and I will call the second, for reasons that will become clear in a moment, the McGinn sense of piecemeal. And what I want to claim is the switch from the conception that was anti-piecemeal to the one that was piecemeal in the Goldfarb sense took place in his working on and completing the Tractatus in the battlefields of World War I. And the second change is the one that takes place, or at least is fully accomplished, in Schulden in 1937, though, as we'll see, under preparation during the years before that. So that's just, again, more overview. Now, in order to achieve this perspective, we need first to distinguish carefully between what I'm saying are these two different things that commentators wind up meaning by this word, without always carefully distinguishing them, so that they seem to be saying a single sort of thing about the character of Wittgenstein's approach to philosophy, in each case calling on the same word to say he has a Stückweise or piecemeal conception of philosophy. So you have two quotations on your handout. These are 2 and 3. I think I'll jump to 2 and 3 and come back to 1. And those are passages from McGinn and Goldfarb. I've tried to make them mercifully short, much to Alois's disappointment, just so we can go through this quickly. There we encounter, very briefly, these two different commentators explaining the sense in which the expression piecemeal does or does not apply to early Wittgenstein's conception of method in the philosophy. So in the former of these passages, McGinn comments in the way in which early Wittgenstein, as she puts it, strives not to treat each of the problems piecemeal, whereas in the second quotation, Goldfarb is explicating the sense in which Wittgenstein's practice of philosophical clarification is only properly understood once it's recognized as, he puts it, essentially piecemeal in character. Thus, on a superficial reading, it might appear that one of these commentators is affirming something that the other is denying about the Tractatus. That is, verbally, their formulations are identical to within a knot. It's the only difference in what they say is one has said something has a not in it when the other one doesn't. So the apparent disagreement might be summed up as follows. Goldfarb thinks early Wittgenstein's method is piecemeal, early Wittgenstein meaning the Tractatus, piecemeal meaning whatever it means, whereas McGinn denies this. So the next thing I want to do, the first thing I really want to do in the talk, is to show you that this disagreement is merely apparent. So I want to examine quickly why each of these commentators is drawn to reach for this concept of the piecemeal in their respective attempts to characterize something about early Wittgenstein and see what they're really each focused on. And I think that examination will reveal, first, that each of them actually has hold of an important part of the truth about Wittgenstein's philosophy at this early point in his development as author of the Tractatus. Second, that it's not easy to keep these two parts of the truth about his early philosophy apart. And thirdly, it's difficult to do that if we don't keep them sufficiently apart, far enough apart, so that we can see how one of them can vary independently of the other. And so we want there to be only one break with respect to this issue, then we cannot see these kinds of changes. Okay. So, McGinn's aim is to try to bring out what's at issue in remarks of Wittgenstein, like those I give you in quotation one on the handout. These are from the notebooks, but these are remarks from the notebook that I think hold for the whole early period. Indeed, as you'll see, in a sense, I think they hold for beyond that. So although there's some things in the notebook that express things that Wittgenstein later comes to see as philosophical temptations, I don't think that's by any means true of everything in the notebooks, and certainly not about these remarks. Let's look at a couple of these remarks. First one, don't get involved in partial problems, but always take flight to where there is a free view over the whole single great problem. Try über das ganze eine große Problem. Even if this view is still not a clear one. So this is a description of what we should try to do in philosophy. It's very much directed against his teacher, Russell. Russell likes to work on a problem, run into it, think about truth, and then say, well, true propositions are ones that represent what exists. False propositions also represent something that subsists in some way because they won't have meaning if they didn't have reference. Why do we prefer true propositions to false propositions? They both refer to a kind of reality. Well, that has to do with what we prefer. That's a problem for ethics. That's not a problem for now. This is a treatise on logic. Or, you know, he's thinking about, you know, the unity of the proposition. He says, well, proposition consists of these parts. But if we analyze it, we have a list. But there seems to be a difference between a proposition and a list of its parts. The proposition seems to have a certain kind of unity. What's the difference between the sum of its parts and the unity of the proposition? Well, that's a problem for logic. This book's called The Principles of Mathematics. So I leave that problem for when we do logic. So Russell's sort of a master of, you know, the division of labor in philosophy. And whenever he hits a really fundamental problem in his work, it turns out to be for another book. Even if that's also a kind of book he writes, you know. And this drove Wittgenstein crazy. He sort of felt this is not the way to do philosophy. The way to do philosophy is, as he put it at one point, to go the bloody hard way and to focus on all of the difficult problems, to see them as all aspects of each other and to treat them together. Not to sort of treat a philosophical problem like a rug that doesn't fit a room. And then you get this corner right, and you get this corner right, and you get this corner right, and you come to the other corner and go, oh, it doesn't fit. And then you smooth that one out, and you go over here and go, oh, no, that doesn't fit. And you just kind of run back and forth from corner to corner. That's sort of what Wittgenstein felt like in his early work in Russell was happening. So we must treat all of the problems together. We must see them, if you will, as all aspects of the one big rug, which is the problem of philosophy in the room of philosophy, and treat them together. This is even clearer in the second quotation on your handout about negation, disjunction, true and false. These are all problems that Russell would, as it were, try to handle. We might say piecemeal, stückweise, one by one. Handle these problems one by one. And Wittgenstein says, no, our conception of what the character of the problems are must touch all of the problems at once. We can't have a completely different kind of solution for each problem, or we will keep running from one corner of the room to the next. So that's a very quick attempt to explain what it means to see the problems as having a piecemeal character in the McGinn sense. And I'm going to argue that up until this period, Wittgenstein wanted to have an anti-piecemeal concept. He wanted to make a breakthrough about what the character philosophical problems were. So it was a unitary conception of what goes wrong in philosophy that touches all of them at once. We'll come back to that. So, just to summarize what I just said, I agree with McGinn that the aspiration first expressed in these remarks, in number one in your handout, expresses an aspiration that shapes Wittgenstein's conception of philosophical method in the Tractatus. And indeed, I want to argue for a stronger claim than she does, beyond the Tractatus, and then we'll have to see how far beyond, but into the period that people think of as ordinarily belonging to the later Wittgenstein. And moreover, I'm going to want to argue that his eventually abandoning this idea represents a very significant development in Wittgenstein's philosophical trajectory. Something very important happens when he gives that up. Indeed, that it represents a shift in his thinking about the nature of philosophy that's no less momentous than the one that happens here, or the one that happens here. But they're all very momentous. I don't have a view about it, which is the really big one. They're all damn big. I don't know what the measuring stick is by which you say which one's bigger. I don't know how to keep score. So on quotation two in your handout, you have McGinn summarizing what's at issue in the passage from the notebooks. Wittgenstein here in this passage instructs himself not to try to treat each of the problems piecemeal. So she uses the word piecemeal, and don't be piecemeal, to sum up the aspiration being expressed in these remarks. I'll return to her point in a moment. But now let's just quickly complete our survey of these two senses of piecemeal. These two senses. As they can be helpfully applied in talking about Wittgenstein, but with different senses. So now we come to quotation three. This is Goldfarb explaining the sense in which the Tractatus now is committed to something, using the word in a slightly different way. One might well want to call, after all, a piecemeal approach to solving philosophy. So now we say he is, rather than with McGinn, he is not committed to a piecemeal approach. So here's Goldfarb on the piecemeal character of the method employed in the Tractatus. I'll just read quotation three with you. The lesson is that nonsense, Unsinn, cannot really be a general term of criticism for the Tractatus. As a general term of criticism, it would have to be legitimized by a theory of language. And Wittgenstein is insistent that there is no such thing in the Tractatus. Logic must take care of itself. Wittgenstein's talk of Unsinn just as shorthand for a process of coming to see how words fall apart when worked out from the inside. What Wittgenstein is urging is a case-by-case approach, and even later says a piecemeal approach. The general rubric is nothing but synoptic for what emerges in each such case. Here, the commonality with his later thought is unmistakable. Now, I think Goldfarb is also saying something true about the Tractatus. But it can be very easy to think they're both saying the same thing, but one yes and one no, and to see, for it to be hard to pull them apart. I also think, as I said, that this change came in this period, that you can see Wittgenstein earlier attempted something more like a Russell Frege view. I won't talk about those things now. I'll just try to clarify what it means to say that something is or is not piecemeal in the Goldfarb sense, so we can distinguish it in the McGinn sense. The sense of piecemeal that concerns McGinn, the sense in which early Wittgenstein's approach to philosophical problems is not piecemeal, has to do with what I will call the unitary character of the method he employs. There's a conception of what philosophical problems are, what causes them, and there's general things one can say. It's true of all of them, such as they involve a misunderstanding of the logic of our language, that we need to employ certain sorts of techniques to solve, that a perspicuous logical notation is an essential tool in their class. These are all things that characterize philosophical problems as such. We need to see this is just as true of the problem of truth, disjunction, quantification, and so forth, to understand these problems and how they're related. So, the sense in which early Wittgenstein's view is anything but piecemeal has to do with what makes it correct to speak of there being such a thing as, if you will, the method of the Tractatus. The sense of piecemeal that concerns Goldfarb is the sense in which early Wittgenstein's approach to philosophical problems necessarily requires a case-by-case approach. It has to do with what I will call the application of the method of the Tractatus to individual problems. And with why, even if there is such a thing as the method, and we have a unitary conception of it, its application, nonetheless, must of necessity be retail and not wholesale. If you'll pardon me a very American metaphor. I'll take the point that Goldfarb is making here. I take this point to be crucial. This is just a little footnote to anything like what people call a resolute reading of the Tractatus. On such a reading, I'll just say two words about this. To regard one of the sentences which make up the body of the work, which serve as elucidations, as Wittgenstein says, one of those sentences in which we understand the author by recognizing the sentence to be elucidated. For one of those sentences to elucidate in that way, in that sense to be a rung on the ladder, which we are to throw away, is to take it to belong to an aspect of a task that the author of the work has set us as readers of the work. And the reader reaches a moment in which she, in this sense, understands the author, understands him, and what he's doing with the sentences that are at issue in this way when he characterizes them as elucidations. When she moves from a state of appearing to herself to be able to understand one of these sentences, or to put it a little closer to the Tractatus' way of speaking, appearing to herself to have conferred a method of symbolizing on the sign, to a further state in which it becomes evident to her that that earlier so-called state of understanding was only apparent, or, to put it a little closer to his way of talking, to see that we only believe that we have conferred a method of symbolizing when we have in fact not done so. We have not given meaning to some of our signs. So the task of overcoming each such particular appearance of signs that each rung in the ladder engenders in us, for such a reader, someone who holds this view, is going to be an arduous one. You have to make a transition from one of these states about certain sentences to another such state. And that has to happen bit by bit. That's a kind of work on yourself that takes time. That must be piecemeal. This, as it were, working through of the method to cases of philosophical confusion. Even if there's a unitary diagnosis of the character of the confusion, the discovery for a reader with respect to these sentences or those sentences, that there has been such confusion, is piecemeal. It must come, Stückweise, one set of sentences at a time. I think it would be wrong to say one sentence at a time. That's an issue I've kind of taken out of my talk, which I talk a lot about in terms of somebody wants to ask me about. But I'll just bracket, as it were, that. Okay. This means that, as Goldfarb says in his quotation, if you read the Tractatus this way, you have to see the Tractatus as having no general story about what makes something nonsense. Indeed, what he's criticizing is the very idea that there could be such a general story. That your ability to distinguish sense from nonsense is an internal aspect of your ability to speak and make sense. That's all part of your capacity to language. And just like the Tractatus is not trying to take you from a point in which you don't understand language at all to suddenly you have language, that's something that happens in the first few years of life, not if you read it to the Tractatus. Similarly, he's not trying to take you from the moment in which you don't have the ability to recognize anything as nonsense to the moment when you do. That also happens at the beginning of life. Indeed, at the same time as the other side of the same coin. What the Tractatus does is confer upon us instruments that allow us to refine our capacity, both to see when we're making sense and therefore also when we're failing. These are two sides of one coin. And therefore, to attain a higher degree of mastery and vigilance in our inhabitation of language. He is altering the character of our relation to language, but not in a way that suddenly, as it were, gives the concept of nonsense versus sense application where it previously didn't have one or had the wrong one. And that is divorced from our capacity to use language. Now, everything I just said is completely contrary to the spirit of most standard stories. Most standard stories, I think, are incredibly influenced by the logical positivist perception of Wittgenstein that took place in the early 30s in the Vienna Circle. Certain features of that reception about the ethical, the mystical, and so forth have been retracted since as having something wrong, but not actually the foundation of those features of their reading, namely the conception of what the book is doing as a whole, how it works, how these categories like logical syntax, sense, nonsense, and so forth work. So on these standard readings, there can be, if you will, a possible moment in the reader's assimilation of the doctrines of the book when the theory, as it's called, of language, not the way Wittgenstein talks, but the way the commentary talks, the theory of what makes something sense or nonsense, the conditions of meaningfulness, once they've been grasped, can be simultaneously brought to bear wholesale on all the sentences in the book. This is also the thing that causes the central paradox in a standard reading, because it also looks like the sentences that articulate the theory are themselves nonsense. Someone wonders, why should I believe that? So according to such a reading of the Tractatus, once we've equipped ourselves with the right theory of language, we can determine what's gone right and what's gone wrong in philosophy simply by applying the theory to each of the things we're going to say when speaking philosophically. So now, I've given you a distinction between two ways of uncovering nonsense. One that's wholesale, that's mediated by something like a theory of what is permissible, the kind of thing that Russell was looking for in a theory of types. And another way of understanding what's nonsense. We have a certain conception of the problems and what it is to use logic to clarify what we're trying to say. But the discovery that we don't mean anything by our words lies with the individual and must proceed piecemeal. Now, this distinction has to be formulated carefully, or it can lead to a distorted account of what these two different kinds of readers of the Tractatus, the standard one and the Goldfarbian one, shall we call them, hold. If one were to claim that one can cover nonsense only one sentence at a time, according to a piecemeal reader, that I think would not be fair. And if you say about a standard reader, his view is there's a moment where you can see all at once that everything in the book is nonsense. That's not fair either. And there's a good bit to say about why that's wrong about both sides. And so then this tends to make people want to say something like, well, for the piecemeal view, you can only see that a few sentences at a time or nonsense. Whereas for the standard reader, if you have the right theory, it really cuts really deep. And you can see lots of things are nonsense. And that makes it seem like the fundamental difference between holding the piecemeal view and holding the anti-piecemeal view is something like the quantity of sentences that, you know, reveal themselves to be nonsense at a time. And I want to say that is not to get the difference between these two readings straight at all. The difference is not a quantitative one. It's a qualitative one. their understanding of what kind of capacity is exercised in understanding this. The crucial thing about the standard reading is that once you've got the right theory, the task of discovering that something is nonsense is essentially a mechanical one. It's the application of a set of principles to cases. It's like a litmus test. You take the sentence and you dip it in and you see how it comes out. So it might take time, the sentences are complicated, to see if they are, you know, unverifiable or counter-syntactically formed. There's actually a lot of standard reading theory, different criteria, you know, that inform these theories. But in each case, it's essentially a mechanical matter to determine it. That is, in some sense, it's preordained by the theory in advance, what is or what is not nonsense. And then there's just the police work of passing a verdict on the proposition. But the subject of the verdict that something is nonsense on the standard reading is the sentence. You can sit over in the corner and say nothing. We're not interested in you. We're interested in the sentence you came out with. And we are now going to analyze it by the lights of the theory and see what its internal structure is, qua linguistic strength. Whereas, on the other reading, in which we see it as piecemeal, it is not a mechanical matter. You have to interrogate what you want to do with the sentence, what method of symbolizing you want to confer upon it, what you would count as a translation of it into logical syntax. It's an elementary point already in Frege that the average English or German sentence is ambiguous between different forms of logical segmentation that can go into a begriff shift in more than one way. The linguistic string in natural language doesn't have something which is its logical structure. That requires, depends upon what we are doing with it and what we want to mean. If there's something you mean that allows you to say, this is the thought I want to express in the Grishra, fine. But the tools, the Tractatus imagines it, will often lead you to see that you are waffling between more than one method of symbolizing, and that what you want is logical features of both. That is, you want to mean something that corresponds to two different transpositions of the same sign into the syntax, and that there isn't anything that is meaning both. There isn't anything which is having this expression, both express a variable and a proper name, to take one of the forms of waffling he discusses in 4.1272 of the Tractatus, when he's talking about what's confused about the expression A is an object. What's wrong with A is an object is not that it's counter-syntactically formed, it's a form of words confuses us, because we want to mean things which, if we get clear about what we can say in a logically clear way of expressing our thought, nothing corresponds to what we want to say. But that discovery, that nothing corresponds to what I want to say, is something I have to make as a discovery. That means the verdict, unsinn, is not passed on the string, which could be rendered as something where it has a variable form or something in which it has an object expression form, and either of those would be fine. The problem's not with the string. It's my relation to the string. It's my failing to give meaning to the words, but the discovery. And my failing to do that is something I must discover. Hence, this is a process that must, in that sense, be piecemeal. Okay. Much more to say about that, but we can't do it now. We are going to move on to McGinn now, again. In the quotation from McGinn, she comments on the passage about the single great problem from the notebooks, item one in your handout, by saying, if you recall, Wittgenstein, this is quotation two, Wittgenstein there instructs himself not to try to treat each of the problems piecemeal. I'm going to close this because it's so damn low. Find myself screaming. Not to treat each of the problems piecemeal. The first thing we need to see is that what McGinn takes early Wittgenstein to be there instructing himself, I think I caused the rain to stop. Wittgenstein takes early Wittgenstein to be there instructing himself not to do, and what Goldfarb takes Wittgenstein to be committed to doing when he says he does treat each of the problems piecemeal, are not the same thing. The ambition touched on the remark from the notebooks about getting this overarching view of the eine große Problem is an ambition that Wittgenstein takes himself to have realized. when he's completed the Tractatus. And it's tied to the remark in the preface where he says, the problems have in essentials finally been solved. The problems have in essentials been solved because the method of their solution or dissolution has been found. The application of this method to the problems of philosophy, the problems that require treatment by this method, is nonetheless, for early Wittgenstein, a piecemeal process in the Goldfarb sense. And indeed, that is why the problems have been solved only in their essentials, or we could say, not in all of their details. It's this latter distinction, if you will, between solving the problems in their essentials versus in their details that mandates the early procedure of piecemeal interrogation of sense. What the Tractatus does is exemplify a method which then must be practiced in application to particular confusions that particular people experience. But that is not to be confused, this distinction I just made between solving the problems in their essentials versus their details, that's not to be confused with what we might call a more fundamental distinction in philosophical conception between the methodological monism of the early Wittgenstein and the methodological pluralism of a later Wittgenstein. That is, a Wittgenstein who seeks to present what he calls an open-ended series of examples of methods. A series that can be continued in both unforeseen and unforeseeable ways, and that can be broken off at any point and then resumed. So a reader of the Tractatus who insists with Goldfarb that the method is piecemeal in the sense that goes with the first of the distinctions. Something still must be done in detail that is piecemeal. Need not hold that they are piecemeal in the McGinn sense, that Wittgenstein does not think in the Tractatus there is such a thing as the method, that the problems have not, in essentials at least, been solved. And a resolute reader who fails carefully to distinguish these two senses of piecemeal runs into the risk of affirming much too strong a continuity in Wittgenstein's philosophy by noticing that this is true of the Tractatus, and then therefore deny that this further development can take place, because everything is already anti-piecemeal, and the only sense of piecemeal that's now being allowed. So, the expression piecemeal, employing the Goldfarb sense, I think is a useful locution for marking a profound continuity across this divide that's standardly thought of as the early-later Wittgenstein divide. And the expression piecemeal, employed in the McGinn sense, is a very useful locution for marking a profound discontinuity across this divide between the early and the later Wittgenstein. But then, about that second discontinuity, when does Wittgenstein reject the anti-piecemeal conception in the McGinn sense? We can ask, when did he do that? And the answer, I do not think, is when he was born the later Wittgenstein on the standard story in 1929. I think the answer is first about 8 years later, and that these are very important 8 years. Now, as I said, to fully document that claim would take a lot of work. But in my closing remarks in the next 10 or 15 minutes, I'll just give you a framework for what that investigation looks like. I think this much is clear, if we have an argument about how to date this, which we might well have, because it's not easy to figure out exactly where to put that date. Whenever this break took place from here to here, it's fully accomplished in part one of the philosophical investigation, especially the sections 89 to 133 of the investigations that we presently have and that were published, are attacking this idea, among others, and therefore also attacking something that runs throughout the early period. Indeed, I think in almost every remark in that stretch from 89 to 133. We have an attempt on Wittgenstein's part to contrast a later way of thinking about the question of method in philosophy with an earlier way of thinking about it. He is throughout 89 to 133 criticizing an earlier self, earlier selves. And in section 133 at the end, he gives us one, not the only, but one rubric for understanding that contrast. This is the last quotation in your handout. Oh, no, it's number 5 on your handout, the last sentence for the moment, where he says, "There is not a philosophical method, though there are indeed methods, like some verschiedene Therapien." Maybe just a footnote about this section, because it's often talked about. But this sentence, when people talk about what they do, is they latch onto the word therapy. They love that word. In fact, I'm supposed to love that word, I'm told, because that's what resolute readers hold. That Wittgenstein has a therapeutic conception. Don't much like any of that, to tell you the truth. One reason to worry about that is just I think not very many people disagree with that. I think Hacker thinks he has a therapy. It's just not clear what we're affirming and denying. But another thing I'd like to point out is that Wittgenstein's not saying there his later conception is therapeutic. The purpose of the sentence is to distinguish the difference between having a conception in which there's a method, there is such a thing as we can call the method, as opposed to a conception in which what we think now is there's a mistake in that idea that's important to criticize. And then we must see that philosophy properly conceived does not have the sort of unity that he previously thought, that it consists of methods. Gleichsam verschiedene Therapien. So the analogy with therapy is meant to illuminate, this is the point of the analogy, the character of the plurality of method. That we can speak of therapies. And we can have a plural. And we can have a conception of why all of these things are therapies without thinking there is such a thing as the therapy. Or the thing they all have in common, which they're always also doing, whatever else they're doing. So it's supposed to illuminate something about the character of how those things hang together. That's the point at which the analogy is supposed to be helpful, as I understand it. But we can talk about that. Now, this contrast between the early method and the later methods draws, I think, many other points of difference between an earlier and this later Wittgenstein together. In particular, the difference between the Tractatus' point of view on the problems of philosophy, according to which they can be and have in essential been solved, and the refusal of such a point of view in the investigations, in which, if you will, the essentials can no longer be separated in this sort of way from the details of their treatment. The confidence expressed in the claim in the preface to Tractatus that the problems of philosophy have in their essentials been solved is tied to a confidence that, at least in its essentials, we can say the basic outline for how to proceed in philosophy, the Grundriss for dissolving all such problems, has been provided by the author of this book. In the Tractatus, that confidence was, in a sense, justified, because it was closely tied to the idea that there is something which is called the logic of our language, which can be laid bare through the appropriate use of a logical notation. Something which is hidden from view, which is not open to us, and that getting it clear, the logic of our language, allows us to see what we need to see what the method is. Hence, the attack on the idea of the method in 89 to 133 goes together with the idea that nothing is hidden. And the idea that there is something which is the preferred form of the expression of the proposition. Indeed, I think the entire stretch from 89 to 133 in investigations can be read as exposing the various latent preconceptions that allowed an earlier Wittgenstein to imagine that he'd been able to survey, I'm going to put this neutrally now, the structure of philosophical problems once and for all as such, in order to attain something like the kind of perspective from which it could then appear to him that in that sense they're all part of one big problem that can admit of an overarching form solution, and that that's what he's provided. And there's still work to be done in the Goldfarb sense of the piecemeal application of these methods. But Wittgenstein has done the important part. He's shown us what we need to do in the approach of philosophical. Now, that last sentence of 133, there's not any method, no indeed different method. Now, it's certainly not incorrect to understand the contrast in play here to be one that marks the difference between a Tractarian methodological conception, the conception of the method, and that of 133, in which there's no such thing as one method, though there are indeed methods. But this is the important one thing now. One shouldn't conclude on that basis that 133 in no way contains a criticism of the person we might just call middle Wittgenstein for these purposes. These labels are all dangerous, but I'll call him middle Wittgenstein for now. The person who's active between 1929 and 1937. Not only its final sentence, but that whole section, and the sections that come before it, on later Wittgenstein, so he says, mature understanding of what he's doing in these passages is now rewritten in this way. The whole point of these passages is equally concerned to draw a contrast between the methodological conception of the investigations as we know it, and the very emphatic views of this person I just call middle Wittgenstein. For despite far-reaching differences in the respective philosophies of this person, call him early Wittgenstein, and this person, call him middle Wittgenstein, there remains the following important similarity between them. Each of them seeks to hit upon something he calls the method. That's what he's trying to do, and at various points, each of them think they have succeeded. This takes us to the last quotation in your handout, quotation 6. This is part of a large family of passages. I could have given you many. I've just given you one. In which middle Wittgenstein is trying to characterize the kind of difference what he's done will make to the history of philosophy if he succeeds in what he's trying to do. And one of his favorite ways of putting this in the context of discussing his, as he calls it there, new method, is to emphasize how, once it's put in place, philosophy is the kind of thing that will be transformed so that now, after him, in contrast to before him, it can become something like, if you will, a technique, a matter of skillful practice. There can be skillful philosophers as there are skillful chemists, because a new method has been discovered, as happened when chemistry was developed out of alchemy. And in your passage, he says, then, the nimbus of philosophy has been lost. For now we have a method of doing philosophy. Compare the difference between alchemy and chemistry. Chemistry has a method. Now, there's a lot of ways to misunderstand this analogy. I think the point is not to say philosophy should become scientific. He's got very clear passage at the same time where he's rejecting that. The analogy has, again, as any analogy, a very specific point of attack. But it has to do with the idea of whether the practitioners have a shared conception of what it is to make progress and a shared set of methods relative to which you make such progress. That's what you didn't have in alchemy. So you had fundamental debates about what they were even doing. Whereas after that, any chemist can recognize what another chemist is doing is chemistry. And in criticizing him, he criticizes him on the basis of a set of shared standards for what it is to get the result you want. So what matters, above all, he emphasizes in this period, is not so much the truth or falsity or the rightness or wrongness of this particular remark or that particular philosophical result, but rather this all-important fact. A method has been found. The contrast between there being a philosophical method, in this sense, for middle Wittgenstein, and there being methods, according to later Wittgenstein, represents, I think, an incredibly important difference in the respect in which later Wittgenstein, Pache, early and middle Wittgenstein, comes to think that philosophy can and ought to aspire to anything like a final and finished condition of maturity, to anything like the sort of finished state, which is the mark of a once immature discipline having transformed itself into a mature one, where there's now a fixed and stable set of procedures given once and for all for treating problems. Which means, if we have that, we can in some sense say once and for all what philosophy is, what a philosophical problem is. That the question of the philosophy is just as stable a question in the midst of a solid answer as the philosophy of chemistry, if you will. Chemistry successfully differentiated itself from the form it took in its infancy through having come to attain a condition in which fundamental methods of controversy are no longer ones of method. So the mark of the condition of maturity we seek here is when the practitioners of the discipline in question at any given time are able to rest content with some, however unsurveyable, at least delimitable number of antecedently fixed procedures for making progress.